Funny Books with Aaron, Polly, Andrew, and Wayne. I'm Aaron.
This is Paul.
This is Wayne.
And I am Andrew.
And I think I got you guys out of order. Like, I shifted y'all around.
It's because Andrew's never here. We threw you off.
Yeah, it's usually Wayne and Andrew, and I went Andrew and Wayne. I mean, that's just weird.
Well, I knew our positions. Yeah, you're used to me doing my Andrew impersonation anyway. So.
Oh, fair. Good point.
Fair. Breeze to fake Andrew.
Yeah.
Probably better than real Andrew, honestly.
Well, and AI Andrew as well. So, you know.
AI Andrew's pretty solid. He's very intelligent.
I mean, sometimes he just makes it's almost like he's hallucinating sometimes, though. Sometimes he goes off the rails.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's just the like interesting Andrew. Part, really.
Look, The Eternals is a good movie. I'm just saying.
Oh, I don't know which Andrew this is right now.
Bad Andrew.
Bad Andrew, regardless.
Right.
Yeah, AI doesn't go off the rails and give that wrong of an answer.
Well, you know, last week we talked about the first three episodes of Ironheart, and we were wrong. They weren't dropping Ironheart episodes weekly after that. They dropped the rest of the series after that. So,
Was there a total of six?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And they dropped the last three this week. And am I still the only one on the show who's watched Ironheart?
Yeah, but not because of any type of like more, you know, I don't know. Like, I'm not avoiding it. I just haven't had a chance because I was.
There are tons of things to watch.
Yeah, it came out the same week as like Squid Game, and I wanted to finish that. So I finished that this morning, Aaron. So I'm ready for Ironheart unless something else starts this week.
Right.
I just have no interest in it until you tell me that it's good.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I want to watch it, but I've not had a chance. It's been a busy couple of weeks, but I'm hoping maybe I can use Ironheart to divert my wife away. Currently, she has gotten into watching Animal Kingdom on Netflix. I'm not going to say it's bad.
Mutual of Omaha's
no, Animal Kingdom? More like a human wild Animal Kingdom. So for me, it's I'm not going to say it's a bad show. But for me, it's kind of the same reason I stopped watching The Shield. It just gets a little too dark and intense for me at times. So I'm not a crazy fan about it, but it's not because it's a bad show. It's just not my cup of tea. But I'm hoping maybe I can divert her because there's six seasons of it. I'm hoping maybe we can take a break and watch some Ironheart.
There's only six episodes of Ironheart. You can talk to it.
Yeah. So that's my plan.
Well, I won't revisit the conversation from last week other than to reiterate that really my objection to the show is not the show itself. I think the show is well written, well produced, well acted, and overall I very much enjoyed it. I will tell you that her armor that she builds for the third act is beautiful, and I need a figure of it immediately. But my overall objection to the fact that she makes poor decisions inside the box, that she's not making out of the box decisions, as we were given to expect from her in our prior exposure to the character, before this TV show, you know, that she's a creative thinker. She's an out of the box thinker. She's an engineer. She solves problems every day. That's her thing. All of her solutions to problems are bad. And sure enough, that's the way the show ends, is that she appears to make another spectacularly bad decision. And I'm just like, what the hell? But don't let that jade you, because I think the show is really good. The money is on the screen. The special effects are fantastic. Unlike an Iron Man movie, she's in the armor quite a bit. I enjoy the armor scene. I enjoy her AI. I enjoy her supporting cast. You know, I have had some issues with the group of bad guys, but, overall I thought it was a really well done show. I think it's worth the watch.
I have a question about her mistakes. Is she making mistakes like smart people do, where like theoretically this seems like a good idea, but if you use common sense or in practical application, it's all an awful idea? Or is this just not a smart choice?
I think it's just all awful ideas. And that she, you know, she's presented with a situation at the beginning of the show where, you know, she doesn't have any funding for her work, right? Mm-hmm. And so she can't think of another way to go about getting the funding she needs except to resort to crime. And I'm just like, what the hell? You know,
She should apply for some more grants. She should go talk to Stark Tech. You know, it seems like there's, yeah, well, better.
And
better
those ways are the questions I was asking. You know, why isn't she, you know, talking to somebody at Stark? Why isn't she calling up her friend in Wakanda? You know, why isn't she, you know, using the resources that she has available to her before going down this alley? And, you know, I think the show would have benefited from an episode of her doing that, you know, yeah, and getting shut out for various reasons.
Or just like a 3-minute montage, yeah, of doors being shut in her face, right?
Yeah. And there's none of that. I mean, you know, she gets booted out of school and that's it, you know. Hmm. Well, there's nothing left for me but to turn to a life of crime. I mean, I was like, you know, this seems inconsistent with the character that we, you know, got to know in the MCU. Yeah. And certainly that we know from the Bendis books. So I found that very frustrating. But if you can get past that, you know, if you can get past the fact that your hero, you know, your protagonist is wildly flawed. And wildly flawed, not just like, you know, Tony Stark's a drunk and he's an egomaniac, you know, it's wildly flawed in that, you know, really no moral compass, you know, really not centered or grounded at all. You know, yeah. Yeah. But I got to tell you, I think it's a really sharp looking series, and there are things I really enjoyed about it. So recommend it, and would love to hear what you think once you see it.
Done.
So are we unable to talk about the ending because of no one's seen it?
You can. I don't think you're going to ruin anything for me. I don't know how Wayne feels about it.
I looked it up after Aaron said that they had a surprise ending.
Yeah, go ahead. Talk about it.
Okay.
So Aaron. Yes, go ahead. Ask your question.
Well, this has been a long, you know, this reveal has been long rumored for the MCU and pretty much the last few TV shows, especially the Agatha All Along show. But I mean, honestly, this has kind of been rumored since WandaVision. And we finally have the reveal of a major Marvel character at the end of Ironheart, of all things.
Yes, played by Sacha Baron Cohen, one Mephisto shows up in the last episode of the series. And he's kind of hinted at episodes before. There's no makeup. It's just, you know, guy in a fancy jacket. He's interesting, but, you know, I've never really liked Mephisto. He's not a character I particularly jazz to. It seems the presence of magic in this series has, you know, seemed odd to me, you know, given the type of character that Ironheart is. And she, you know, Paul, do you remember Zelma from the Doctor Strange books?
I do.
Yeah. She's in the series. Oh, and okay. And screen accurate Zelma. I mean, you know, she seems, you know, very, very, very similar to the character in the book. And, you know, is sort of her guide through, you know, the world of mysticism. I dug that, but again, it just seemed weird that, you know, we're going to have Ironheart fighting magic folks when she herself is technology. But, you know, they have a solve for that, such as it is in the series, but that I won't spoil for anybody, but. I don't have any real preconceived notions about Sacha Baron Cohen. I don't think I've ever seen a movie with him. I'm well aware, but I don't think I've seen anything.
You never watched Tal Dix?
No.
Oh my God.
Borat? No Borat?
No Borat.
I wasn't a Borat fan, but I love him in Talladega Nights.
I'm not a Sacha Baron Cohen fan anyway, but I think it's interesting casting, but we'll see. I don't know.
Yeah. It seems to me like you wouldn't cast someone like him if you're not going to use him in a larger capacity, right?
Correct. Yes.
And so I'm real curious as to what they're going to set up. And it does position Ironheart to have a larger role in the larger MCU storyline than I otherwise thought, right? And so I'm curious where they're going with that.
It's weird to me you cast a comedic actor as Mephisto.
Well, I don't think that's too surprising. I think that a lot of our comedic actors have broader acting chops than we tend to give them credit for because they're silly on screen. Like Robin Williams, for instance. He's dead.
So when Mephisto shows up here in Ironheart, does he offer her a deal?
Yes.
Ah, okay. I'm excited to see this.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you know, also, I mean, Sacha Baron Cohen, a lot of times, though, his comedy is from playing straight characters,
right.
Not necessarily from playing a slapstick character. So he's decent at putting on a role and sticking to it, even when everyone else around him is being ridiculous, like when he's playing the, European driver, race car driver in Talladega Nights.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, I like I said, I recommend Ironheart.
Well, I will have to give it a watch. You know, I'm curious about it. I just haven't gotten a chance to. So
yeah,
I'll check it out.
And well, like I said, the final armor is amazing.
I'm gonna tell Reagan. You said we have to watch Ironheart before we watch any more Animal Kingdom. If she has a problem, it's a moral imperative. If she has a problem with it, she needs to call you about it.
That's right. You tell her just give me a call.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and I don't want to. You know, I'd much rather sit at home on the couch watching Ironheart on my TV than you know going to a theater.
Well, you know.
So, or an AMC theater.
An AMC theater. You know, so,
you'd watch for commercials at home.
Right. I mean, kind of. So, you know, recently there was a lot of talk at like, you know, these movie theater conferences. And, you know, there's been a couple of things lately, like CinemaCon and stuff like that, where some movie distributors and like movie studios, you know, think about how do we draw people into the theaters? And one of the suggestions was that was rather controversial was less trailers and commercials before the movie. Because, you know, movie theaters, that's frankly how they make their money. They're not making it off of the ticket sales for the actual movie. They're making it on concessions. They're making it on advertising fees. That's how movie theaters actually make their money. Well, AMC has kind of gone the other way. Because I feel like the average, it used to be, you know, over the last few years has been like 20 minutes of trailers, you know, whatever before a movie and Coca-Cola commercials and the Nicole Kidman AMC thing. And, you know, also them telling you that you're seeing the movie in IMAX, even though you know that because that's the ticket you bought. That annoys me. Like you're preaching to the choir. I know I'm seeing this in Dolby. You don't need to show me three times. But now instead of actually cutting any of that down, when you purchase your movie ticket, AMC has a little footnote. You know, on the ticket purchasing page that warns people that there will be 25 to 30 minutes of commercials before actual start time of the movie. And I'm a bit torn on this.
You are?
I'm torn because like the 25 to 30 minutes, I don't know, like I've gotten used to it, whatever. Like it's annoying. I don't like the fact that they've now figured out how to just like intersperse the Coca-Cola commercial between the trailers. That way you can't just show up after those. You know, because it used to be those were the 20 minutes before the screen, before the start time. Then the start time would happen, and you'd see the trailers. Now right. You've got, you know, now they've, you know, put the TV commercials in there. My concern about that one, and this is an odd one, and it's probably an annoying old guy one, is that you're basically encouraging people to show up late to the movie now, and that annoys me even more. And
I mean,
there's 20, 30 minutes of trailers. I'm just going to roll in 25 minutes late to the start time.
Well, and when you have assigned seating, I think that is actually the right thing to do. As long as you're still there as the trailers are rolling, as long as you're not walking after that movie has started, like if you're walking in past me and I'm still watching a trailer for Megan 2.0, I don't care. That's fine. Good timing on your part. But yeah, if you're walking in after the movie's actually started, that's definitely more irritating. Yeah, but in 20 minutes, for me, I just dislike it. I'm not torn. It's bad. 20 minutes is already about 10 minutes too long for me. Plus, when you're watching a two-hour movie, as I get older, you know, bladder issues become more of an issue.
I do find it hard to plan, right? Like, you're like, okay, this movie, I'm going to buy tickets for the 1 o'clock showing. It'll be done around 3. Well, no, now your movie's actually going to be done around 3:30, 3:35. You know, because of the 30 minutes of trailers before the movie.
But if it's a Marvel movie, you're staying all the way through the end credits.
And you're staying all the way through the end credits. Yeah. Now we're talking 3:45.
Right.
And now you have bladder rupture and you're going to the hospital and you're going to need surgery. And
that's
going to
take at least a week to heal up.
I would love to see someone have this happen and then sue AMC.
Well, yeah. It bugs me that, and I know I'm a minority here, but it bugs me that they're adding so much time into the experience that it isn't rewarding time. That's not time that people are going, yeah, that's great. You know, because I remember back in the day, people were like, we want more trailers. Give us all the trailers. And now we've got
before they were readily available on YouTube, I think.
Right. And, you know, now we've got all the trailers in the world. And I'm like, start the movie. You know?
Yeah. I remember being so angry the first time I saw a TV commercial before the movie for like a soda product.
Yeah. Mm. But, you know, that's your time that they're taking. And they're not reducing your ticket price.
Yeah, I am
by adding these ads. You're paying. You are still continuing to pay a very high price for your movie ticket and your concessions, and they are selling your time, and you're not getting any compensation for that at all. That I object to.
As it is right now, the ads are just about long enough for at the places I go, at least, that I can go. Get my drink, get my popcorn if I'm doing any of that stuff, all of that while the ads are going and get back in time for the trailers.
Mm-hmm.
A half hour worth of stuff. I mean, I'm going to do exactly what Paul says. I'm not going to show up for a half hour.
Yeah.
As it is, I don't feel any sort of rush like I used to before. It's like I had to be there at time
because I had a good expected seat. To start.
Yeah. Well, that too, but
yeah. But now that you have assigned seating, you don't even have to be there early to get a specific good chair.
Yeah, I mean, I'm someone who already hates the movie experience. Like, I hate movie theaters. I hate being around the people. You know, I basically just hate going, but I go because I want to see these movies right away. And this is just one more reason. I won't go to an AMC. Like, knowing this, knowing that that's their plan, as it is, I'm not... AMC is not one of my regular theaters, so it's no big loss. But when I'm looking at available theaters in the area, if a movie's not at a good time for my preferred theater, I will not go to an AMC anymore. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, I make the choice that I see a lot less movies in the theater than I used to. I used to, you know, it used to be one of my favorite things. It was to go see a movie a couple times a week. And over time, because of various things, that's reduced. But certainly the worsening movie-going experience, the increase of streaming, the decreased amount of time it takes for a film to get to something like streaming, you know, the increase of, you know, surround sound at home and big screens and high def, I just see way less movies now. And this is just probably going to make me see less in the theater when I'm making that decision.
Yeah, something I never thought I'd say. That's something I miss about the COVID era. I miss having some movies come out day and date right there on streaming and be able to watch it at home instead of going to a theater.
I miss the pandemic.
I don't, but...
You know, I'm always going to go see Superman and Fantastic Four and the other big tentpole superhero science fiction films at the movie theater. It's always going to happen. But I am seeing fewer of them. And, you know, like, I didn't go see Mission Impossible. When it came out, and I've seen every other Mission Impossible. I'm going to wait and watch that on TV because it's just not that big a deal for me anymore. You know, I think what this is doing, and let's be clear, AMC is the first one out of the gate to say this. The others are going to follow.
Well, I'd love to see someone smart take the opposite position and say, you know, this is the wrong thing. This is going to keep more people home, less people in the theater. Mm-hmm. We're going to go... Maybe not a lot the other direction, but we're gonna go a little bit in the other direction.
Well, and let's be frank, they're not making the kinds of movies that they used to make. You know, that you don't have everything's genre and children's film these days. You very rarely get something that's just, you know, a simple little, you know, legal drama or a thriller. You know, it's going to fit. That's not going to fit in some sort of four quadrant sort of film. And
there's plenty of rom-coms out there still too.
I agree. There are still plenty of rom-coms, but you know what I'm talking about is like, you know, whatever happened to the 90s thrillers, you know, you don't have those kinds of movies anymore. Suzanne and I have a real devil of a time trying to find something to go see at the movie theater, you know, that short of going to an art house, theater, you know,
yeah, but yeah. That's what Reagan and I were having the same thing the other day. We ended up going to see Breitheart.
Breitheart? I've not heard of this one.
It's a Rebel Wilson film with a couple of the people from Pitch Perfect. And I won't, we don't need to go into the thing here. It was okay. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay.
It was a nice trip out with the wife. But it's not anything I would have missed if I'd never seen it.
Yeah.
I have an interesting story about my movie going experience this week in relation to this very topic.
Yes, sir.
Earlier. And
what
this
movie
week,
did you see?
F1.
Okay. Yeah.
Which I loved. Very, you know, kind of to your point about 90s. I wouldn't call it a 90s thriller, but it is very much a 90s style Bruckheimer type movie. Jerry Bruckheimer produces it. And so, you know, those Jerry Bruckheimer movies like Top Gun and Days of Thunder and, you know, and that kind of thing, it very much has that feel with the Hans Zimmer score and the good looking people. And, you know, it's not like there's no big bad. There's no, you know, hole in the sky. It's honestly, it's just a great film. I thought F1 was great. Highly recommend it if you like that type of entertainment. You know, you don't need to be an F1 fan to enjoy it, I think. In fact, if you are an F1 fan, it probably takes away from your enjoyment of it because it's not terribly realistic for F1. You know, it kind of breaks the rules in a way that take you a little bit out of the story if you actually follow F1, but regardless. But here's a funny thing. We ended up going earlier this week because I wanted to see it in, I looked up, I'm like, what is the biggest movie screen in Metro Detroit? And funny enough, it's 5 minutes down the road from us. And so I'm like, oh, okay, perfect. Because I wanted to see this, you know, I know they filmed this, you know, with IMAX cameras. They introduced new technology to, you know, actually film the cars on the track. Like it's not, you know, there's not a lot of CG. It's mostly practical, you know, cars and car action. And so I wanted to make sure that we saw it in a great screen. And unfortunately, or fortunately, whatever, depending on how you feel, the new Jurassic World movie was starting on Wednesday. So our last opportunity to see it on this giant screen was Tuesday. So we, you know, I bought tickets for the 6:30 showing at our local movie theater. We show up, you know, wait in line for soda and stuff. And you know, I look up, you know, the movie house and we're in movie house number 8. And I'm like, yeah, but, and I'm looking at the ticket. I'm like, yeah, but number 8 isn't the Super EMX is what they call it. The Super EMX theater. The Super EMX theater is 14. And I realized, gentlemen, I bought tickets for the wrong movie theater.
And oh, no.
At this point, it's 6:32.
Oh, no.
I realized for the 6:30 movie, the 6:30 screening I purchased for it was an hour away. So I went to the counter. I'm like, do you guys have a showing of F1 at 6:30? They're like, no, but we had one at 6:20. And so they swapped me out, and I was able to get into the 6:20 showing literally right as the movie was starting. And so this is one situation where those 20 minutes actually helped me to not miss any actual movie because I'm a bonehead and I bought tickets to the wrong movie theater, which I don't know. As I get older, I'm pretty bad about that stuff. Sometimes I buy tickets for the wrong day because I forget to change it from today. I mean, to buy it right for Friday, I bought it for today, but this one was like, it worked out, but those 20 minutes of Coca-Cola commercials and advertising Super EMX, even though you're in the Super EMX theater, helped me out.
The theater, know how that happens, Paul. Yeah, somebody did it at the last movie I was at. I went to, it was the Minecraft movie. It was the last one I saw in theaters. And someone was standing out in front of the screen and realized that it was 3 to 4 hours before their seat, you know, the movie.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was a couple. And then they started arguing about whose fault it was.
Oh, good times.
The theater that I've been seeing movies at recently, having moved last year, they have something I've never seen before. They have showings where they'll have the closed captions up on the screen.
I've seen
that. They'll advertise it. You know, they'll say, you know, this screening will be, you know, on screen, you know, closed caption subtitles. I'm like, that is so cool. And then they'll also have screenings where they'll do the Spanish track. And I'm like, that is so cool. I mean, they make it super accessible. You know, I was like, man, that is really super cool that it's kind of barrier-free movie watching. That's something I think more theaters ought to be doing.
Now, the one thing that I can't suggest is, I think it's called Screen X, maybe, where I saw the A Quiet Place, I think the most recent Quiet Place movie in it. Mm-hmm. And it's a 270-degree multi-projection system. So the screen is in front and, you know, obviously as a normal movie screen, but there are also screens on side that wrap around you.
Oh, cool. Oh,
yeah. So, big no for movies that aren't designed for that. It's really cool when you have something where it's designed. Like, we have a Omnimax at our Science Center, and sometimes they play movies. I saw Batman Begins there, like, years after it came out. And I actually got motion sick during the previews because they previewed the Johnny Depp Willy Wonka. And it's fine on a normal screen, but when this screen wraps around you and you have something with so much kinetic motion and you're already in seats, like in this, in our case, it's very vertical seats. I mean, meaning like each seat is high up with a little walking space because of the room it's designed for. And I have never gotten motion sick during anything, but I had to close my eyes and I couldn't watch Johnny Depp.
Was that the motion sickness, or were you just sick of Johnny Depp?
A little bit of both.
That's what I experienced. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I do not recommend, you know, like to Wayne's point, unless the movie is filmed for that, and most movies are not, it's just an odd experience. I feel like it took away from the film more than added to it. But, you know, one of the reasons we're talking about movie theaters, and especially AMC theaters, is that this coming week, most of us, I think maybe all of us, I don't know, are planning on seeing Superman, right? So Superman starts next week, July 11th officially, but, you know, there are screenings starting on Tuesday if you're an Amazon Prime member, you know, of course, Thursday preview screenings. So, you know, all throughout the week, we'll be seeing Superman and talking about it next time we podcast. You know, and at least my Amazon Prime screening is in an AMC theater. I don't know where you guys are planning on seeing it. So I will have my 25. I don't know. Because it's an Amazon Prime screen, I don't know if it's going to have the 25 to 30 minutes of trailers or if it's just.
It's all going to have advertisements about Prime Day.
It's going to be Jeff Bezos' wedding video.
There you go. There you go. Yeah.
It's going to be a live address of Jeff Bezos from his moon base, threatening the world with a death laser and wanting $1 billion.
He's going to be moon advertising base. Comixology. That's what he's going to be doing.
Moon base Prime.
Moon base Prime.
Yeah. The question will be, who will have seen the movie the most times before we record?
Not me. I'm going to see it once, unless it blows my damn mind.
Yeah, I plan on seeing it once before we record again. But you never know. I might go back on like Thursday or Friday.
Hey, I hope it's that good. I hope it's that good. Trailers have not convinced me it's that good, but I hope it's that good. But
well, let's see. I'm a little worried about crypto, but I'm just saying I'm a little worried about crypto. One of the things that I
was a little concerned about when I bought my ticket last night for this coming Friday, it's heavily weighted to the 3D experience. There were lots and lots of 3D showings, and it was hard to find, you know, a standard viewing.
Does that surprise anybody that they're still like having 3D movies?
It's same. I just, same. And you know, but it was, you know, I'm seeing it at AMC, and the, you know, it's all real D 3D. And I'm just like, damn, that's a whole lot of, you know, 3D showing.
A whole lot of D's.
Yeah. And I was like, I didn't realize that 3D was still a thing.
Yeah. I didn't have that issue in my area. When I looked at it, there were 3D showings, but there were only a couple. It was by far not the most common showings in the area. Maybe 3D is just not popular here, which is good because
3D I hate it.
It doesn't add to the experience for me.
Yeah.
I used to see a lot more 3D movies because I would get free movie tickets for like advanced screenings on Thursdays. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, those, if it comes in 3D, will be in 3D.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I can only think of one movie where I felt like it was actually done well and it added to the movie. Other than that, it's always been a horrible experience. And if you happen to have somebody near you that's wearing way too much perfume or cologne and your eyes start watering, the 3D will start giving you headaches.
Look, I said I'm sorry.
Specific instance. He likes him some CK1. He can't help it.
It's Axe body spray.
That's what it is. It's not called, it's not perfume. It's Axe body spray.
That's right. Well, I'm excited for Superman. I am optimistic that it's going to be awesome.
It better be awesome because I've gone all in. I have bought every toy. I have multiple shirts. I just keep buying things with the new logo and the new everything new. And it better be good, because if I'm stuck with all of this stuff and I'm disappointed, I'm going to be angry.
I've been there. But let's hope, for Wayne's sake, let's all hope that the movie is good. For all our sakes, really, because it's Superman and it's the start of a DC universe. And if the movie sucks, that's really going to hurt, you know, us getting additional DC movies.
But, yeah.
You know, in anticipation of Superman coming out, we wanted to revisit. I'm cautiously optimistic. But, you know, in anticipation of this movie coming out, we wanted to revisit one of the most classic Superman stories, the one that has informed every Superman story and movie produced since it. John Byrne's Man of Steel, a 6-issue series from 1986.
I think that's correct.
I think, yeah. And so, you know, we thought this would be a good time to revisit that. It's a 6-part series post-Crisis on Infinite Earths. You know, retelling essentially like a Superman Year One, just not called that. Well, I guess the first few years of Superman, really, because they refer to 3 years passing. But, you know, this was your idea, Aaron. And I will tell you, I have not revisited this story, I'm going to say, in over 20 since I was a lad, I would say. Since probably the 80s or 90s, I've not revisited this. It's been a solid 20 years since I've read this book, at least.
I definitely had revisited it before, because I have the trades when they started releasing that era, and I bought a bunch of them as they came out.
Well, you know, I thought that it might be beneficial to, you know, revisit John Byrne's The Man of Steel in advance of the Superman movie, because, you know, like you said, Paul, everything that's come since then, you know, over the last 40 years, has owed something to this series. The idea of it was to reset Superman after Crisis on Infinite Earths, when DC, you know, realigned all of their continuity and threw out the stuff that they weren't satisfied with at the time, and, you know, really kind of came back to simplify and more ground their characters like Batman and Superman. And so John Byrne, who had previously worked almost exclusively for Marvel and was really seen at that time as sort of the fixer. You know, he was the guy who came in and fixed your problems on a series. And, you know, Fantastic Four was not performing like Marvel wanted at the time. And so when John Byrne came in, he really got it back to its core and got back to that thing that we talked about a lot on this podcast about core concepts to the characters.
Yeah, and it was a really good run.
Oh, and I love that run. It's one of my favorites of Fantastic Four. And let me say, John Byrne at this time was a superstar. I mean, there wasn't anything John Byrne touched that just wasn't magic. Drew phenomenally. I found his writing very entertaining at the time. And so when it was announced that he would take on Superman, I was like, this is going to be great. And I was reading comics at the time. I bought The Man of Steel number one when it came out in July 1986. I was all there for it and was super excited about it. I was absolutely on board for everything about this. Like Paul, it's been a while since I have read this, probably not 20 years. It's probably more like, you know, 10 or 15 since my last read of it. So, you know, it was really welcome to kind of revisit. And I, you know, one of the things that I think we'll talk about as we're going through is some of the things that I attributed to Byrne aren't really his. You know, that they happened later in the run. Like, this was certainly foundational, but some of the things that I really clicked on about this era, the beginning of this era of Superman, was actually done by other writers. So But I got to tell you, this book kicks off really strong. The art direction in the book, you know, John Byrne's designs for Krypton, I think, are just iconic. I love his view of Krypton. It's not the you know, ice crystal era Krypton from 1978 Superman movie by Richard Donner, but it does have the chill of that. So, you know, the tone is cold, you know, that, you know, Lara and Jor-El, you know, they're not, you know, physically close, emotionally close. It is a very, you know, emotionally distant sort of space. And I think something that's really key about the origin of Superman here, just, and you're not beaten over the head with it. You know, it's kind of in retrospect that you realize it, but Superman wasn't born on Krypton in this telling. He's born on Earth. You know, he is in the Matrix chamber that is launched in the dying moments of Krypton. And, you know, he never meets his parents. He has, you know, even, you know, in the prior issues and in the prior stories that had been told, he has, you know, faint baby memories of his time on Krypton. Well, he didn't have those here because he was taken from the birthing matrix, you know, a la, you know, Zack Snyder's Man of Steel, and, you know, launched into space, you know, before he's ever born. And I find that really interesting. But I've talked a lot. I'll let you go.
That was a huge part of Byrne's origin. He wanted Superman to be American, to be actually a citizen. And to do that, that's why he had him not technically be born until he landed, because that way, you know, birthright citizenship. He's a citizen of the U.S. Because that's one of the big things about Byrne's Superman, is that while he is genetically Kryptonian, he is very much Earth first. He was born, raised. He didn't know anything about Krypton. He doesn't even know the planet he's from till the end of this series. Mm-hmm. And that is years into him being Superman. And at that point, there's a whole final page speech where he talks about how, you know, it's nice to know all that, but I am human first. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a big part of the character. For me, I've always really resonated with this version of Superman, where so much of him is informed by having grown up in Kansas and being a Midwesterner, and that's who he is primarily first. I love having the Kents back. I've always liked having them. But this is an interesting version where they don't say that he's adopted. Like, the Kents pretend that he's biologically theirs for all of his life until, you know, finally telling him. That's a pretty big twist on some of the early versions, where the original Superman origin, he was immediately taken to an orphanage for a while.
Yeah, it's, you know, I find, you know, so just kind of speaking in the series as a whole, because it's been so long since I've read it, I found it interesting that it doesn't really tell one cohesive story through the six issues, right? At least in my mind, it tells six different vignettes throughout the first number of years of Superman, but there's not a single plot thread that necessarily carries all the way through, other than the connection to his parents. But even then, that's really only revisited from issue one to issue six. I have never cared for the portrayal of the cold, careless, you know, cold, uncaring Krypton, right? The no physical touch, the, you know, the total science, you know, aspect of Krypton. I've never really cared for that portrayal, and this is where that really started. You know, oddly enough, when it comes to Krypton, I think my definitive, or I shouldn't say my definitive, my favorite origin of Krypton and Superman is probably the one from the Superman animated series back in the 90s. You know, the Paul Dini, Bruce Timm version of Krypton that also incorporated Brainiac into the Kryptonian destruction. And I really thought that was a brilliant way of portraying the origin. So, you know,
That's one of my favorite versions, too.
Yeah. So even though the redesign of Krypton, which is actually one I really care for, much like you, Aaron, like, I like this Krypton visually. I've always gravitated to those like green and black Kryptonian suits, and I've never been a fan of the ice, you know, the ice structure. Like, I like this more. I've always liked this Krypton visually, but you know, in actuality, I just didn't care for how cold they were. Like Jor-El, you know, not, you know, basically is, you know, like, well, I shouldn't even say it's Lara, right? Who's like, you took the baby? Like, how can, you know, like, there's a shirtless man and I'm horrified and, you know, that. Things like
I
that.
Love when never she's like,
that resonated.
I love when she's like, yeah. Such a beast. Touching the uncoached, untreated soil with his bare hands.
Head to hair.
Right. And I think that, you know, to your point earlier, Aaron, this was really foundational because even though these six issues are not necessarily telling one cohesive story, they set up plot threads that would then be, you know, carried forth in Byrne's Superman and Action Comics runs, right? So, like, Lex Luthor, really, this is just a start of Lex Luthor, right? You know, the Batman relationship, really just the start of it. Like, there's, you know, but it's like these little pieces that come up throughout. And so, I will tell you, reading it, I can see it. It was more an exercise for me in being fascinated by the context of the time and what came after than it was for me like, damn, this is a great Superman story.
It really made me want to read more in that era. Keep going. Because one of my favorite Superman stories is the introduction of Supergirl in that era and how they bring her in. That one is not too far after the relaunch. It happens fairly quickly.
The
a couple of years.
I agree, Paul. It's foundational. It's the, you know, building blocks that we're going to build all of the wonderful 90s era Superman stories on. I also agree that, you know, you're kind of getting vignettes, right? You know, because these six issues span several years, you're getting kind of a sense of where Superman is at various stages in his story so that, you know, other writers can come and flesh that out at a later time. And John Byrne does a lot of that because he is on the Superman books for 2 years following this. I very much appreciate, you know, that they grounded Superman in that he is not, you know, so godlike as he had become in the pre-crisis books. You know, he's not the guy who's going to go out into space and move a planet as he had done in books earlier. You know, he is super, but he is not, you know, crazy, omnipotent super. You know, he has to hold his breath if he's going to go out space. And while he can hold his breath for an extended period of time, he can't just, you know, fly across the cosmos without, you know, a respirator of some kind. You know, I love that about him. I love where it starts the Batman-Superman relationship, that they don't trust each other. You know, they're wary of each other. Whereas, you know, in the books, you know, they're best buddies right from the jump. You know, and I like that. I like that there's a, you know, I got my eye on, you know, Batman, you know, and, you know, Batman's very much a, yeah, I got my alien, you know, I dig that about these books. What I had some issues with is Lois's, depiction in the book. And, you know, I think that's a lot to do with the year this was written in. You know, Lois is absolutely written as a real go-getter, but boy, you know, there's just some things that really strike my ear as rough. And you have to forgive the fact that this was written in the mid-80s, right?
Yeah. She's not terribly likable, you know, like Superman, no. You know, at one point expresses having feelings for her, and I'm like, but why?
Why? Yeah. Yeah.
At no point in the book does she do anything really redeeming or I mean, she's very opportunistic. She's very aggressive, you know, in a good, like, with her career and stuff like that, but at no point do you see any warmth.
Yeah, no, she's like outright vicious to Lex, making comments about his balding.
Well, and I guess this was acceptable in the 80s. But, you know, you're reading it like, why would you be wearing his gifts? Why would you be wearing the dress and jewel he sends over to you? You know, why would you do that, Lois? if, you know, you're not going to accept them, if you're not going to, you know, lean into a relationship, you're going to take as gifts, you know, that sort of suggests a deeper relationship. So that's bothersome to me. But, you know, I think the thing that, that despite the lowest piece there, she's drawn beautifully. You know, she is, all of the artwork in this book is fantastic. And I think the thing, there are two things that I think I love the most about this book. And it's one of the arguments I have about the new Superman origin that we read a couple weeks ago. It's that Clark Kent emerges on the scene already accomplished. You know, he's a published author. He is not clumsy, oafish Clark Kent. He is accomplished Clark Kent. He is Clark Kent with a past. He is Clark Kent with ability. And, you know, he can write in addition to, you know, obviously cheating a little bit with the, you know, a Superman story that, that gets him his job with the Daily Planet. But, you know, he has abilities. He has skills. And I love that, you know, he doesn't, you know, while he softens his appearance with the glasses and slicking back his hair, he doesn't look like a buffoon. And I love that about Clark Kent. And then I think the real gem in this storytelling is the resetting of Lex Luthor. And I think this rings relevant right now is billionaire villain Lex Luthor, you know, CEO of a megacorp, and you know, just as hideous and evil as he possibly can be, and you know, vying against Superman for the adulation and respect of the people of his hometown. You know, that
and being so out of touch that he just doesn't understand.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I've always loved the ending of the series. Spoilers. The ending of the series is that, you know, Luthor has done all of these horrible things. He's tried to kidnap the Kents. He has kidnapped Lana Lang and tortured her to, you know, get whatever secrets he can from Lana, because he's established some kind of connection between Superman and Clark Kent. They pump all of this data. You know, he's got a whole team of folks working on all of the information possibly get around Clark Kent and about Superman. Punch it into the computer, and the computer comes back and says Clark Kent is Superman. And he doesn't believe it because he cannot grasp that Superman would ever pose as a mere human being. And so he rejects it and says it's wrong, you're all fired, yada, yada. And, you know, it's hilarious.
If he thinks that, if he can't imagine a world where Superman would pose as a regular human being, why is he searching for him? Like, if he's looking for all these people, obviously they're all going to be regular human beings.
I didn't think that he was
Superman poses as a regular human.
I didn't feel like he was looking for a secret identity. I think he was looking for a secret origin, right? Like, where did he come from? Where has he been? You know, I don't think it ever occurred to him that he would ever, you know, put on a jacket and tie and post. I read it.
Yeah, I did think it was hysterical how he just didn't look at a picture of Clark Kent and a picture of Superman. Like, yeah, okay, that's, yep. Oh, could be. That could
yeah, be. Same guy. Same guy.
Looks real similar. Takes those glasses off. Maybe gets doesn't slick his hair back. Could be the exact same dude.
Yeah.
The one thing I really miss about this origin that I don't feel like we have anymore, if you have him as Superboy first, I really like Lois being the one to give him the name Superman. Same. That is a huge part of the origin that has been big for me. And I like the S-Shield being something created with Ma Kent and, you know, her creating the costume. That's a big part of the origin for me, too.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting when they're like, I noticed when you were a child that clothes that were close to your skin never got dirty or tore. I was like, huh.
Yeah, that's something.
But, you know.
He starts hinting at aspects that he brings in a little further into the writing, and some of it he never got to. The idea that Superman's invulnerability is actually a projected field around him is part of the Byrne origin. That's something they did in Superman and Lois and Clark, the TV show, as well. But that's a big thing he's hinting at. That's when she says clothes close to him don't rip and tear, That's why it's a protected field. He talks about how the boat feels lighter when he's flying. That's because Byrne really wanted his super strength to be partially telekinesis. That right. never came out, though. That's something that he kept hinting at, and that he never actually came out and said. Though they did give tactical telekinesis to Superboy when they created him.
Yeah, I got to tell you, some of this is dated in the way the story is told. Like, it is very chatty. We would absolutely complain about this book if we were, reviewing it as a current release. Like, oh my God, yeah. there's so much dialogue on the page. But that's also the way John Byrne writes. I mean, if you read his Next Men or any of the other books he's written, I mean, he is Johnny Exposition. He is writing all about it. When his artwork really does a terrific job of telling the story. And, I do feel like John Byrne would benefit from an editor. But, when you're a superstar, you get to do whatever the hell you want to do.
I think this is the first time I've ever read Man of Steel. I don't think I've ever read this before, but I enjoyed it. It very much put me in the mind of Superman for All Seasons by Jeff Loeb. And one thing I guess John Byrne wrote a little bit for the collected edition in 1991, where he was talking about his exposure and how he started to learn about Superman when he was growing up for a while, and that he would comment that you'd read these episodes at 2 to 3 stories per issue, 6 or 7 pages per story, and that wouldn't really fly in today's market at the time he was writing. And now, of course, that in these days it seems like he's writing, he's condensing a lot by our standards. I also thought it was interesting that for the first year, he didn't really realize the shield was an S. Like, the first year as a child of him reading comic books, he didn't recognize the shield on Superman's chest as being the letter S. And so, at least as of the time he wrote this little, he still draws the shield by drawing the negative spaces first, by drawing the yellow bits. And then that's kind of his positive space when he draws it, which I found fascinating.
That is fascinating.
Yeah. So one aspect of the story that I am conflicted on is Lana.
Yeah.
I like him doing the reveal of his powers to Lana before he leaves. But the part at the end of the story where he sees Lana again as an adult, and it's been all these years later, and he has no idea that he ruined her life, that she's traumatized by knowing that he's out there and has these powers and that she loves him, but he's never going to be, hers. I don't think I like that reaction to it. So I really like him revealing the powers and, sharing that part with her, but I don't like traumatized Lana.
Yeah. I didn't care for traumatized Lana in that regard, or did I appreciate the fact that she gets tortured? Right. I mean, the torture piece is really kind of a calling card of John Byrne's. I mean, his stories really
seem... Just a caveat for the reader. Like, if you're reading the 6 issues, that doesn't happen in these 6 issues, right? That comes much later in the run, near the end of Byrne's run. But, yeah. And, yes, to your point, that's kind of one of the reasons we stopped reading John Byrne books.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's some things that I don't care for in Byrne's run. I think this is the strongest part of his run, with some other good, really good stories afterwards that he builds on. But there are some things about the run as it goes on that I don't care for. I don't like that Lex scene of him, having the computer tell him that it's Clark and just firing everyone. I like that idea that he would never accept it, but the fact that he wouldn't then just have Clark killed, just to be sure.
Yeah. You just have someone have it posed as a robbery, a mugging, have someone shoot him, and then when he doesn't die or get injured, be like, oh yeah, I guess he is Superman.
I'm glad we revisited this because, again, within the context of the time period, it really was fascinating for me to say, okay, this informed this, this informed this, every iteration of Superman. And, we're going into this new Superman next week, which has been told, it's not going to have an origin story, though we know there's a Pa Kent in it. There's rumors of a Jor-El in it, so
I think we'll get some aspects of it. And I'm curious to see how this informs that, because yeah, pretty much every iteration, every origin, everything of Superman has something to take from this John Byrne origin story. And so good idea, Aaron. I won't beat you up on this one.
Well, and I apologize. I didn't realize that I read past the assigned pages. I read all the way up into 2 of Superman, which is why I was talking about the being tortured. When you said I'm like, that's not right. Yeah. So yeah I read a little further. So apologies.
I remember that issue. I bought that issue when it came out, and I remember how like cool it was. But that was after this.
Yeah. A lot of the trades include a little bit further than just the original miniseries. Yeah. I mean, because we don't even get to the part there where him and Big Barda make a porn.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
Yeah,
that's
good stuff.
I feel like Wayne's suggesting we revisit that story.
I think that we've got to make a porn with Big Barda. I mean, and why would
we? First of all,
I want no part.
Well, I have to say, I'm glad that we dove back in. You know, there are so many things that came out of this this run that John Byrne established. Planting seeds, you know, the idea was to reduce the Superman family to a family of one, right? That you just have Superman, you wouldn't have Superman, you wouldn't have Supergirl, you wouldn't have Crypto, you wouldn't have any of these other survivors of Krypton. And when we first get Supergirl, to Wayne's earlier point, she doesn't hail from Krypton. She is, you know, an artificial. You know, when we first get Superboy much later, he is a clone of Superman and Lex. And, you know, this thing really was the standard origin of Superman until Mark Wade wrote Birthright. And I think that it did so much for our understanding of who Superman is in this modern era. What the animated series was based on, for crying out loud.
I want to go back and rewatch some of the animated series now.
Damn straight.
Talking about it. But yeah, you also get into, with that Supergirl story, that's where he learns that he will never kill again. He kills the 3 Kryptonian villains, and it doesn't just, like in comic books, killing just is a thing that happens, and people don't have to deal with consequences mentally.
Yep.
He gets PTSD from it. He spins off an alternate personality for himself.
Gangbuster.
He is traumatized by his actions to the point that he doesn't feel like he deserves to be Superman and leaves the planet for a while.
Yeah.
It's like, I love that. If you're going to have Superman cross the line, show the consequence of it mentally.
Yep. Yeah. I love this series. I loved it when I read it. I really enjoyed revisiting it and, you know, recognize some of its shortcomings, but it is a piece of its era, and you have to read it in that context. And it is so visionary, and, you know, take somebody who loves the character and really puts his spin on it. And, you know, it has lasted for generations. Years, guys. Crazy. I love it. I'm glad we read. And you know, we're gonna do the same with a little bit of Fantastic Four. Not a Byrne story, but we're going to revisit the first Galactus story in Fantastic Four in advance of the Fantastic Four film. Be on the lookout for
that. Oh yeah, I forgot we were doing that.
Yeah, don't forget, Paul.
Yeah, I've only got a few weeks.
Yeah,
I guess I do too.
Hey, Paul.
Yes, sir.
What's coming out next week?
Well, speaking of Superman, big week for Superman, both in the theaters and in comic books. We have the latest issues of Absolute Superman and Action Comics coming out, as well as the Superman Treasury 2025 book. This is something that we talked about a few weeks ago. It's an all-new Treasury edition written by Dan Jurgens with art by Bruno Redondo. It is... You know, though most of us read our comics digitally, this is an oversized Treasury Edition art book. Brand new Superman story. I'm looking very forward to it coming out. So I'll definitely be picking that one up.
Well, that sounds good. Looking forward to that as well.
Yeah, and from Marvel Comics, if you are getting ready for the Fantastic Four, two Fantastic Four books coming out next week. Fantastic Four First Steps, Issue 1, which is written by Matt Fraction with art by Mark Buckingham, and is set in the universe of the comic, or excuse me, of the upcoming movie, as well as the an all-new Fantastic Four number 1 from Marvel Comics from Ryan North, the current writer on One World Under Doom, as well as art by Umberto Ramos, Wayne's favorite.
Well, we'll get two copies of that for Wayne.
Yes.
Excellent. Excellent.
We want to know what you thought about Ironheart, and maybe give us share your thoughts about John Byrne's Man of Steel. Give us a shout at Ideology of Madness. I mean, if we use your comments on the show, you could win a coveted, valuable Ideology of Madness surprise.
You can also hit us up on social media, IOM Geek on Facebook, Instagram, and X.
Guys, next week, Superman.
Superman, very exciting. Can't wait to talk about it with you guys.
Same.
All right, we'll talk to you then.
Up, up, and away.
All right, see you next week.
Podcast theme music graciously provided by Mark Andrew Pope. For more information, visit markandrewpope.com. Funny Books with Aaron and Polly is a production of ideologyofmadness.com. No Spider-Man clones were harmed in the production of this podcast.